Falmouth. Today is April 2nd, 2007, and I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3328. Andy.
Thank you, Chair. House Bill 3328 is a bill that would modify the procedures involved in child abuse investigations. And I believe there are some amendments this morning, but I won't try to kind of digest or tackle those. Chair, perhaps, Representative Esser.
Representative Gelfand, do you want to speak from here or over there?
I think over there. And if it would be at your pleasure, Mr. Sheehan and Ms. Dimrest and I would constitute the first
Terrific.
Panel.
Terrific.
And kind of walk you through it.
Great.
At that point. Does that work?
Okay, go ahead. So David Sheehan and Joan Dimrest.
You kind of wait for the experts to walk
through. I think that walk through is the way to
get the operative word. Right?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Sarah Gelser, and I represent House District 16, which includes the portions of Benton County that are Philomath and Corvallis, except for the part of Corvallis that belongs to Representative Olson. I'm bringing to you today a bill, House Bill 3328, that stems from a tragedy that happened in our community in June of 2005 when we saw the death of a young child as a result of child abuse and torture. The bill seeks to standardize the practices for child abuse investigations statewide and to help ensure that children have access to child abuse medical assessments and that physicians have the tools that they need when they're doing examinations of children to understand the condition that they were in when law enforcement or child protective services workers found them. In a little bit, I will walk you through the bill. As you know, there have been many amendments to the bill. A large group of people has been working on this, and I'm especially grateful to the Department of Justice and the Department of Human Services, the Juvenile Rights Project, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and a number of other organizations who've been very helpful in trying to make this bill work. But before we get to walking through the bill, I'd like to take you a little bit through the history of how we got here. And for that, we have two members of my community, Mr. David Sheehan, who is Carly's father, and Joan Dimrest, who is the district attorney that prosecuted the case against Carly's killer. And with that, I would invite David to start.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Sheehan. I am Carly's dad, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this morning. I would like to start by telling you a little about Carly. Carly was born on January 4, 2002, in Good Samaritan Hospital in Corvallis, and was a joy from the outset. She was smiling at us a few days after she was born, and kept on doing that for the rest of her life. She was innately kind and considerate of others. Despite a few earlier scuffles, Carly acted as a peacemaker at daycare, ensuring other kids had toys and mediated disputes. She loved dolls and tea parties, along with pickup trucks, jeeps, and insects. Carly was bright and friendly. I cannot count the number of times I would look at her asleep in my arms and wonder how I was so blessed to be able to call this girl my daughter. Carly had a wonderful sense of humor, and reveled in the prospect of being silly. After doing something questionable, she would like to debrief on whether or not it was silly or naughty. She then progressed to a fractional perspective, asking if something was a small bit naughty and a big bit silly, which seemed to be acceptable to her. Carly's ability to outwit adults and beat us on technicalities was also gaining momentum. Carly and I spent countless hours in Avery Park in Corvallis, a beautiful park that now bears a little memorial playground in her honor. One evening it was time to go home, which Carly was not pleased about. I insisted that we leave, telling Carly, "You need to hold Daddy's hand so we can go home." She raised her right hand to grasp my left hand, or so I thought. With her hand a few inches from mine, she paused and grabbed my wrist instead. We walked off into the sunset, evening sun, back to the car, almost hand in hand, but not quite, and I really can't tell which one of us was feeling the proudest. As many of you are aware, Carly was brutally murdered in June 2005 by Filth named Sean Field. He had abused Carly prior to her death. DHS began investigating suspicious injuries to Carly in November 2004, barely 2 months after Field came into her life. I could talk for hours about my views on the efficacy of that investigation, how certain fundamentals were completely ignored, how incorrect conclusions were hastily reached, how bias meant that certain people were trusted more than others. But the substantive issue this morning is improving the investigative process. Clearly, investigations like this are in need of improvement. Cardi was brought to my house at 10 a.m. on Saturday, December 11, 2004, to begin her week with me. I was shocked when I saw how she looked. I took a photograph of Carly in my arms around lunchtime, and a second around 7 p.m. that evening, I could finally get her to sleep by herself. Between December 12 and 14, 2004, I sent these pictures to DHS with an expectation that something would be done. Apparently, the pictures were lost. During a visit to a DHS office on December 13, 2004, a DHS employee also took pictures that apparently were also subsequently lost. As I recall, the pictures were taken with a 35mm SLR camera, so I do not know if they were ever even developed. Cardi was bruised primarily on the left side of her head, consistent, of course, with being injured with Field's right hand. During the trial, it became apparent that Field shared with DHS how the bruising had occurred. Cardi inflicted the bruises by pushing her thumbs into her head in this manner. Had they shared this with me, not a trained physician, I would have suggested that they ask Field why Cardi didn't have bruises on the right side of her head. During December 2004, DHS had enough information to stop Field, but their focus was elsewhere. The abuse dwindled or perhaps ceased for a while, but an anemic investigation emboldened that filth to pick up where he left off, which he did, culminating the systematic torture and brutal murder of my daughter in three horrific days in June of 2005. The system desperately needs a mechanism where photographic evidence is collected, quickly disseminated, and reviewed by the right people. At some point during the investigation into my daughter's injuries in late 2004, DHS had photographic evidence along with Sean Field's ridiculous excuse as to how the injuries occurred. They were the custodians of both of these pieces of information, but they never got reviewed by the right person. I am unable to come to terms with why photographic evidence of this gravity was dismissed. Why, when it was lost, DHS did not contact me for replacement pictures. It would have taken literally 1 minute to email them for a second time. Photographs and the tangible documentation they provide are ubiquitous in law enforcement, industry, and society in general. I understand that any new legislation and practices will take some effort and resources, but the cost of inaction and maintaining the status quo is overwhelming. Every single day since Cardi's murder features moments of profound sadness, some fleeting, maybe lasting a few minutes, and other times it lasts for hours or days, I should say. And when it does, I have learned to pause and reflect on what Cardi went through, and my personal anguish disappears, and I quickly stop feeling sorry for myself. I will not ask you to act so no family will have to go through what we did. I do ask you to act so no little boy or girl will have to suffer like Cardi did. As I previously mentioned, it is difficult to understand why tangible photographic evidence was not factored into the abuse investigation. As an outsider to the process, it is probably more astonishing that physicians or other medical professionals with special training in child abuse detection do not currently review cases. I recently looked into donating some excess furniture, and it became apparent that if I wanted to value it above $500 for tax purposes, I would need to have it professionally appraised. So we have a trained individual review $501+ of furniture, but not the evidence associated with Cardi's well-being. Needless to say, if Cardi's situation was professionally appraised, then I believe things would have turned out different. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this morning. I implore you to give this legislation your support. While I do not pretend to completely understand the nuances of the bill, I do believe it will better protect Oregon children. Improved processes that are adhered to will offset bias against fathers, unfortunate decision-making, and other aspects that hamper the investigation into what happened to Carly. I sincerely appreciate Representative Geltzer and Joan Demarest for their efforts in bringing about change. It is important to Carly's family to keep her life learning any way we can, and this bill might well be her biggest contribution. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sheehan.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joan Demarest. I started prosecuting cases for the Benton County District Attorney's Office over 10 years ago. Last fall, I prosecuted the case of the murder of Carly Sheehan, State versus Sean Wesley Field. After over a month-long trial, Sean Field was found guilty of murder and torture of Carly Sheehan and sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 45 years. He'll be eligible for release when he's 80 years old.
Carly was beaten by her mother's boyfriend, Sean Wesley Field, for the last 9 months of her life. At age 3 and a half, she endured her final beating, lasting 2 to 3 days. She ended up suffering 60 visible injuries to her tiny body over a few days. If you have knowledge about child abuse, you know that much physical abuse does not result in any injury at all. Carly had over 60 visible injuries to her body. The final blow that caused her death resulted in injury to her brain that is similar to that seen when children are in a severe car accident without any restraint device. This case has an enduring impact on everyone who has learned about it because of what a delightful child Carly was, because of the horrific brutality that she suffered the last 9 months of her life, and most importantly, what brings us here today, because of how utterly preventable her death was. We have layers and layers of safeguards in our system to protect children, and Carly slipped through every layer. This legislation will close the gaps and prevent more children in Carly's situation from being murdered on our watch. Because in this case, law enforcement, DHS, Carly's physician, and the Benton County Child Abuse Response Team, which is comprised of court-appointed special advocates, CASA members, DHS, ABC House. ABC House is all about children. It's a facility that does medical evaluations of children who are suspected of being victims of child abuse. Members of the DA's office sit on the CART team. We have members of law enforcement from three different agencies sitting on the team, and also members from the juvenile department. This team staffed Carly's case twice in December of 2004, 6 months before Carly was killed. And all of these agencies and all of these protections failed Carly. Despite our mandatory reporter laws and the multiple layers of protection, only something like HB 3328 could have prevented her death. I'll go over a few of the facts of the case, and if there are questions about more details, please ask me. In September 2004, Carly was 2 years old. That's when Carly's mother, Sarah Sheehan, who is present in the audience today, along with her parents, Carol and Jean Brill, in from Pendleton, to support the bill today. Sarah Sheehan and David Sheehan were recently divorced. Sarah Sheehan met Sean Field, and they quickly began a serious relationship. Sean Field manipulated her in a number of different ways. Experts who have reviewed the facts would describe it as a typical domestic abuse case. There was emotional abuse, economic abuse, yet very little physical violence. Experts will tell you that this type of abuse, this emotional abuse, is much more effective at controlling people and much more damaging than physical abuse. Soon, Sarah Sheehan was doubting her intelligence, her judgment, and she became afraid to question Sean Field. Or challenge Sean Field. She also became financially dependent on him and was turning over all of her earnings to him, and he would give her money when she asked for it, if he approved of the proposed spending. The defendant began abusing Carly shortly thereafter and somehow coerced Carly, who again was 2 years old at the time, coerced her into saying that her daddy was hitting her. Carly's daycare provider noticed, however, that Carly would be extremely distraught when she knew she was going home with her mom to the defendant's house, and she would be very happy and relieved that she thought she was going home with her dad. Before long, Carly's behavior had significantly changed at daycare. She was missing hair. And finally, on November 17th, Carly's daycare provider, who was a mandatory reporter by law, notified DHS, and an investigation began. DHS, I think it was the next day, met with Carly and her parents at Carly's physician's office. Corvallis Police Department trained detective, a detective specifically trained in child abuse, investigated the case as well. And the case was staffed at that point by the Benton County Child Abuse Response Team. The defendant told Carly's mother and DHS that Carly was pulling her hair out and that Carly was saying that her father was hitting her. No one asked who had actually seen the hair pulling. If somebody had asked that question at that time, they would have discovered that the only person who said that they saw her pulling her hair out was Sean Field. Carly's physician, DHS, and the Corvallis Police Department all concluded that Carly was pulling out her own hair and hitting herself. No one besides Carly's father took pictures to document Carly's appearance. Carly was not seen by a physician with expertise in child abuse. Being less than 3 years old and likely threatened by the defendant, she was unable to disclose what was actually happening to her. On Saturday, December 11th, after a week of visitation with her mother at the defendant's house, Carly was returned to her father looking horrible. People described her as looking like she was a chemo patient, looking like she had been in a car accident. Most of her hair was missing, and she had bruises around her head and face. Carly was exhausted and clinging to her father and couldn't sleep if he put her down. David brought Carly to the neighbor's house to document her condition as he received her. He also took pictures and left several voicemails on the DHS caseworker's voicemail. Friends at the neighbor's house reported Carly's condition to the DHS hotline, and later that night, a Corvallis Police Department patrol officer went to David Sheehan's house and looked at Carly Sheehan. He didn't take any pictures himself, but he did look at the pictures that David Sheehan had taken and confirmed that those were accurate. The patrol officer then went to talk to the defendant, Sean Wesley Field, and Sarah Sheehan. Contrary to common practice, the defendant and Sarah Sheehan were not separated when the patrol officer spoke with them to try to ascertain what had happened. Representative Olson could certainly tell you that it's commonplace in law enforcement to separate different witnesses to ensure that one witness is not influencing the observations of another witness. In this case, that did not occur. So the story that the Corvallis Police Department got was the story that Sean Field said about Carly Sheehan having her hands and fists and her thumbs poking at her head. A trained physician could tell you that this is not possible, that you do not see what was seen in Carly Sheehan as a result of what was described. However, as you know, no trained physician was aware of this fact pattern. So the Corvallis police officer, the patrol officer, closed his case as unfounded and decided that it was self-inflicted injuries. That report, so that was Saturday night. That report went to the trained child abuse detective with Corvallis Police Department Monday morning, and that again was staffed at the CART meeting Monday morning. The detective...
Describe CART, please.
I'm sorry?
CART. Could you tell us what that stands for?
Child Abuse Response Team, again comprised of the District Attorney's Office, law enforcement, court-appointed special advocates for children, those agencies. The detective elected not to follow up on that incident, on that report, because as a result of the patrol officer having determined that the injuries were self-inflicted. So no further action was taken. The DHS investigation, the Corvallis Police Department investigation, all ended shortly thereafter. The conclusion was that Carly was inflicting the injuries upon herself. That was also a conclusion that Carly's family physician agreed to. On Monday, David Sheehan took Carly to the DHS office. DHS took pictures of Carly, and those pictures were again never shown to anyone, were lost, misplaced, or stolen. DHS had a break-in a couple months later in which a camera had been stolen, and it's speculated that perhaps that was the camera used, but it's not really known for sure. On that Monday, David also took Carly to her physician, and again, the conclusion was that the injuries were self-inflicted. David also emailed his digital photos that he had taken on Saturday to the caseworker at DHS, and those pictures, as far as we have been able to ascertain, were never shown to anybody, and they were also lost. Dr. Carol Shervinak, who's the remarkable expert in the field of child abuse, she is the staff doctor at the ABC House, All About Children, and I believe she's going to be testifying today. She was consulted generally about this case via telephone, but she was never shown any photos. Within days, the case was closed with the understanding that Carly was probably having some stress because of the new living circumstances with her mother's boyfriend. And the agreement was that Carly's exposure to the defendant would be limited. Carly's condition improved, and over time, Carly was increasingly exposed again to the defendant. In spring of 2005, Carly started showing signs of abuse again. Her behavior was starting to change. She had some mysterious bruises that showed up. David Sheehan became concerned again. And at the time, he was planning to move to Portland for a different job. And an agreement was made that Carly would go to Portland with him. And that was supposed to be happening shortly after Carly was ultimately killed by Sean Field, beaten to death on June 3rd, 2005. Had this bill been in place in 2004, I believe that Carly Sheehan would still be alive today. Please do all you can to make this bill become a law. I would like to also mention that the Oregon District Attorney's Association supports this bill, and Kevin Neely is supposed to be here in the room to answer any questions. If I could add one more thought, in addition to this bill, I think that there's one other way that the legislature can make a difference in preventing future Carlys from being murdered, and that is by increasing funds for domestic abuse education and other preventative programs. As a prosecutor who's handled hundreds of domestic violence cases, I considered myself an expert in this subject, and it wasn't until this case that I learned. I talked to a number of experts that we retained as expert witnesses, and I learned that emotional abuse can be much more devastating, much more damaging, and much more difficult to identify and difficult to overcome than physical abuse. And commonly when we talk about abusive relationship, we say, well, there wasn't any physical abuse, but la, 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 minimizing the effect that the other types of abuse can have, and when actually it's quite the opposite. The problem is you can't really prosecute a lot of the type of emotional abuse that occurs because it's free speech. So I'm not proposing a change in the criminal law, but what I am proposing is that, and what I am asking is that all of you support increased funding for domestic abuse programs, and that we all make our terminology when we discuss the issue more informed by using the term domestic abuse and not just limit it to domestic violence. This case, I think, is makes that distinction very important and very vivid. I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. We are so profoundly sorry for your loss. Thank you for coming to testify. Thank you very much. Would open any questions, or unless you would to say more.
I do. I'd like to walk you through the bill, and you might have questions for either Mr. Sheehan or Ms. Imrest as we move forward. And Susan's bringing you each a folder now that I want to walk you through. I also wanted to...
Representative Olson has a question.
I'm just curious, and actually, Joan, this is for you. Since you were the prosecuting attorney in that case, and I sat back over at the Albany side watching closely what was going on, do you see 3328 helping with the direction of the prosecution? Because it seemed like there was some serious contentious issues going on during that trial, and I'm just curious if this will establish a lot more groundwork, better direction for, you know, to support where you were going from a prosecution perspective.
I'm not sure. Most of the contentious stuff with the case that I was aware of didn't really relate to photographs. However, I would say that as a prosecutor, physical evidence is gold, and if we had... if we hadn't had David's pictures, I don't know if we could have successfully prosecuted the case. And as you know from your work in law enforcement, pictures are gold. And I think that this bill will dramatically increase the ability of the state to effectively prosecute child abuse cases.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Great. Thank you. I wanted to explain to you briefly the photos that you have. These are the photos that have been described in the testimony that's come before me. These are photos that were taken by David Sheehan. The first photo of Carly in her Christmas dress was taken on Sunday evening. The other photos were taken. She went to Fields home the next day on Monday. Those other photos were taken the following Saturday when she returned home. So that is a change that took place over the course of five to six days. And again, I give you these pictures not to upset you, but rather to point to the importance of having trained physician access to photographs to be able to understand what was happened. Because despite the photos that you see there, this case was dismissed as unfounded. And according to the Oregon Administrative Rules, a case that's unfounded for abuse is one in which no evidence of child abuse or neglect was identified or disclosed. And that was the determination that was made after this child and these photos were seen by law enforcement and also the DHS field office. So hopefully this bill will help to address some of those things by bringing in some expertise that can help to understand the difference between a tale that goes with an injury and one that is made up. And on the issue of self-inflicted, I wanted to mention here, we had a work group on Monday. There were a lot of individuals there. And in the Dash 2 amendments that we adopted and in the original bill, there was a section that talked about protections for children for whom their injuries were believed to be self-inflicted. The idea of putting into statute the idea of a child self-inflicting injuries upon themselves was very disturbing to everybody around the table because it is so rare and so unlikely to happen that has been completely removed from the bill because we don't wish to give any credence to that idea. But just as a review, in 2004, DHS reviewed 46,524 reports of suspected child abuse and neglect. At least two of those reports were about then-2-year-old Carly Sheehan. Of those 46,524 reports which were reviewed, only 7,307 cases, or about 15%, were founded. Carly was one of the 39,217 children, nearly 85%, whose case was determined to be unfounded for abuse for lack of evidence that abuse had occurred. Carly was killed, as we've heard, in the summer of 2005 when she was 3 years old. In 2005, DHS reviewed 55,114 reports of abuse and neglect. Only 14.1% of those cases were founded. And although she died that summer after the systemic torture and abuse at the hands of her killer, Carly was not the subject of any of those reports of child abuse or neglect. When Carly died in 2005, she was one of 18 Oregon children whose deaths were directly related to abuse or neglect inflicted by their parents or family caregivers. Including Carly, 16 of the children killed by their parents and caregivers that year were under the age of 5. And in fact, for children in that age group, this is the second leading cause of death, is to die as a result of abuse or neglect at the hands of your caregiver, which makes children of this age extremely vulnerable because they are unable to speak up to explain what has happened. And also, their ability to seek help is somewhat limited by those that may be abusing them. They have to consent to many of the parts of an investigation that would help to reveal the abuse or neglect. During the sentencing, the judge that oversaw this case, Judge Holcomb, cited a continuum of failure in the response to Carly's abuse over the course of the last 8 months of her life, and she said that the community was due for some deep soul-searching about whether timely intervention might have saved Carly. And Holcomb said that if we are really willing to look at ourselves, this might be one good thing that comes from this tragedy. This bill is an attempt to do that. And so I'd ask you to pull out your Dash 3 amendments, and I'd like to walk you through what this does, how this would have helped, and how it could help other Oregon children from facing death. And more importantly, we also have to remember, while an average of 19 children die in Oregon each year, you have to remember the number of children who are emotionally harmed, who face severe physical injury and lifelong disability as a result of the injuries that are inflicted upon them by their caregivers. Section 1 of the bill cites this as Carly's Law and allows us to call this Carly's Law since it was inspired by her situation. Section 3 is the part that really talks about what would change in child abuse investigations. Right now, every county has a multidisciplinary team which sets out their own protocols for child abuse investigations. These are very different from county to county. This would standardize some pieces of that investigation. You'll see on line 12 reference to a phrase, suspicious physical injury. This is the part that the work group is still working on. Physical injury is defined in another part of the Oregon Code as something else. We've added the word suspicious physical injury for this section of the bill, but there is some concern that could be confusing. suggested additional term was apparent abuse. The concern that some have raised about using apparent abuse is that could make it very difficult for people to make that referral to a physician, because it's a very difficult thing for someone to say, I think this child is being abused, or to say to the parent, these are symptoms of apparent abuse. But whatever we end up calling this, this is a definition of the types of injuries that would cause a child abuse investigator, whether that's a child protective services worker or a law enforcement officer that's going out to the scene, to say this child needs to receive a child abuse medical assessment. And these include burns or scalds, extensive bruising or abrasions on any part of the body, or any bruising, swelling, or abrasions on the head, neck, or face, fractures of any bone in a child under the age of 3, because it's very unusual for a child to have a broken bone under the age of 3, multiple fractures of a child of any age, dislocation, soft tissue swelling, or moderate to severe cuts, loss of the ability to walk or move normally according to the child's developmental ability, unconsciousness or difficulty maintaining consciousness, malnutrition or failure to thrive, injuries causing serious or protracted disfigurement or loss of impairment of the function of any bodily organ, or any other injury that threatens the physical well-being of the child. The purpose of describing these things here are to kind of give a trigger to law enforcement or to child protective services workers when they're there, that they see these types of injuries. It really does require a trained professional to be looking at them and assessing whether the caregiver's description of how those injuries occurred is consistent with the type of injury that the child is displaying. So when this child is found to have this injury, and it's important to remember that this is in the course of a child abuse investigation, so already someone has called and made an allegation of child abuse or neglect, it now becomes one of the approximately 40% of phone calls that go into a screening center that someone goes out to investigate, that they follow up on. When they get there, the child presents with one of these types of injuries. If all of those things have happened, then that investigator will immediately photograph or cause to have photographed these physical injuries that the child has experienced. That is not only for prosecutors who might be prosecuting a case later, that's also for the physician that might be visiting with the child later. Some of these injuries, some abrasions, red marks, slap marks, hand marks on a neck, those can fade over the course of 48 hours or a day. So it's very important for that physician to be able to see the condition of the child at the time that they were encountered by the child abuse investigator. I skipped over the important part, which was lines 5 through 11, that when a child presents in this way, that child abuse investigator will ensure that that child is seen by a physician who is trained and qualified to provide a child abuse medical assessment. And we're going to talk a little bit more later about who that person is. That's addressed a little bit later in the bill. The other thing that's important here is that it indicates that each time a new injury is reported, each time a new allegation is reported, this investigative process will start again. If you think about Carly's case, one of the things that's important to remember is that initial investigation of Carly's injuries concluded about the time that the picture of Carly taken in the Christmas dress was taken. And so when law enforcement and child abuse investigators went out the following weekend, that was in the context of the allegations having recently been dismissed or unfounded. So it's very important that past experience not color a new investigation or assessment when a child is repeatedly coming to the attention of child abuse investigators. So these photos will be taken every time of these qualifying injuries, and the child will be evaluated when they have these serious kinds of injuries. Recognizing that, especially in rural parts of the state, it might be very difficult to get to this trained person, the bill does allow that if reasonable effort is made to get the child to this type of physician and it can't happen, that the child will go to another physician who will then consult in some other way with a physician or medical professional. It could be a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant that is qualified to conduct a child abuse medical assessment. And we do put in the bill that it is important, to the extent possible, not to have that person that does the examination be the child's own pediatrician or family physician.
Representative, let me stop you for a minute. So the person that you're saying, if there's a physician, say, in a rural area that is not qualified to do that, so how would a nurse practitioner or somebody else in a rural area become qualified to make that kind of observation and assessment?
And we're going to talk about that a little bit later in the bill, but this was a request of a number of folks to include the physician assistants and nurse practitioners. There are some in our state currently that are able to provide this service, and that really helps to expand the access. And I think Dr. Chervinet can probably talk to that a little bit more later. However, when they are going to a physician in their area, we do want them to be consulting with this person, even if it's in another part of the state, within 72 hours of that visit. And again, being able to share those photographs that had been taken. Section 5 or sub 5 points out that nothing in this section, although you're going through this process to get the child to a doctor within 48 hours, if a child needs immediate medical attention, the child needs immediate medical attention from an emergency room or an available physician. And there's nothing in this that is intended or will prevent a child from getting the medical care that they need when they need it. The next part of the bill, sub 6, says that if the So now we have a child that sustained these injuries, they've gone to this physician, and this directs that physician to refer this child to existing developmental services that are available for young children, early intervention and early childhood special ed services. The physician will call in the referral. The parents would still need to provide consent for the child to be screened and evaluated, but this is an opportunity to plug some vulnerable kids into services that they may very well be qualified for. Section 4 asks that the Department of Human Services assign a critical incident response team after there is a child fatality of a child that's been known to the agency. This process was designed by stakeholders a couple of years ago after a couple of high-profile deaths of children that were known to the agency. Governor Kulongoski was part of putting that together. Right now, it's not in statute that be triggered. In Carly's case, although she was known to the agency, although it triggered media attention, and although they were very serious injuries, it did not trigger this critical incident response team, which basically is an external review. Every county does a child fatality review, but those are the folks that, especially in a community the size of mine, that were involved in this process, for whom a child death, a child fatality, is extremely emotionally distressing. And it's only appropriate that we ask people who are outside the situation to be looking back to do the systemic review of what could be done better. They make recommendations for training, policy changes, legislative changes, and those are published and made available to the public. This bill leaves the discretion to the department to continue putting the procedures for that CERT team in their administrative role. The bill also specifies that we shouldn't have law enforcement or CPS workers out taking photos of intimate areas of children, that is a task that should be done by medical professionals. In Section 5, it also talks about the disposition of the photographs after they're taken. It allows for them to be printed in hard copy, put in the child's folder, shared with all of the people that need to see them, and made available. When there's a multidisciplinary team that's staffing that child's case, the members of that multidisciplinary team would have access to those photos at the next meeting at which they were staffing that child. When I look at those photos that you've just seen, I can't imagine that if the multidisciplinary team that was staffing Carly's case had seen those photos, they might not have said, this needs a further look, this needs further investigation, this family needs some help, this child needs some help, let's see what else we can do for Carly. And that's the point of having those go to the multidisciplinary team. So if you flip all the way back to page 7, and we're in sub 9. This asks that each multidisciplinary team kind of survey the resources in their community and identify at least one physician, physician assistant, or nurse practitioner. It can be more than one, but it needs to be at least one, who has been trained to conduct child abuse medical assessments and is regularly available to conduct the child abuse medical assessment that we've described earlier in the bill. That person doesn't need to live in the county. They don't need to practice in the county. They just need to be available for consultation. And earlier in the bill, it allows this person to provide that evaluation or this person's designee. So this person has some knowledge of who it is that's doing the evaluation. Recognizing that not every community has this available to them right now. There's another provision of this bill that I'm very excited about, which says that every multidisciplinary team needs to identify this medical resource that's available to them. And if they can't, after reasonable efforts, by September 1st of 2008, they'll submit a report to the Department of Justice that describes what is needed to get that expertise in their community. Is it recruitment? Do they have providers who are willing, but they need training? They need continuing education training. What would the cost of that be? The Department of Justice would compile these reports and bring them back to an interim committee of the legislature, hopefully our interim committee of the legislature, in October of 2008, which would help the legislature in making targeted policy and budget choices in the next biennium that would allow us to make this resource available to children across the state. And also in October 1st of 2008, we're asking the Department of Justice, all of these multidisciplinary teams will submit these reports to the Department of Justice, who will, in that report back to the legislature, report on the general progress of the implementation of Carley's Law, as well as any unanticipated fiscal consequences of implementing the bill. It's important to point out that asking that kids have access to these assessments is not new in Oregon law. We already ask that children have access to child abuse medical assessments. In ORS 418.7801B, it reads, no child in the state should be denied access to a child abuse medical assessment because of an inability to pay. The cost of not assessing and treating abused children with the aid of specially trained personnel is too high. Later on, in 418.780, it says that the purpose of the section of law is to establish and maintain sufficient county multidisciplinary child abuse teams to conduct timely investigations of allegations of child abuse and provide comprehensive services to victims of child abuse through coordinated child abuse multidisciplinary intervention plans, and to provide sufficient regional assessment centers and community assessment centers in Oregon to ensure that every child reasonably suspected to have been subjected to child abuse receives a skilled, complete, and therapeutic child abuse medical assessment. That is current law. All this bill does is creates the triggers to get them to that place. Recognizing that this isn't necessarily happening, that's why we're asking the MDTs to report back if there does end up being a fiscal impact or a fiscal consequence to them during the implementation of the bill. Finally, if you flip to page 9, lines 23 to 27, it says, upon the conclusion of a criminal case involving a child fatality, or upon the conclusion of a direct appeal if one is taken, the district attorney may submit a letter to the governor and the director of human services outlining recommendations for the systemic improvement of child abuse investigations. This is here because if you can imagine, there is no one that is going to better study the circumstances surrounding a child's death and all of the systems that were at play leading up to the child's death than a district attorney who is investigating a case to prosecute a homicide and a possible capital case. It's important that there be a function and an ability for them to be able to give that information back to the department and to the governor to look for systems improvements. I think that the last thing that I would want to point out is that, again, in Oregon, about 18 children die each year as a result of 19 children die as a result of abuse or neglect. And it's not just the children who die, but those who go on to abuse their own children when they get older, those who have physical injuries. And we also know that 2/3 of those receiving substance abuse treatment were also abused as children. Only 1/3 of people who have direct knowledge of a child abuse situation are willing to report that to the authorities to seek help. So the numbers that we hear of the allegations and the substantiated cases, there are a lot of other kids that are out there. We've got to address that issue in other ways. This bill addresses the most vulnerable of the vulnerable, who someone has reported, who the investigator gets there, they're injured. We need to get them to a doctor. We need to photograph the evidence. And we need to make sure that no matter where you live in the state and you're a child, that you're protected if this tragedy happens to you. The last thing that I would point out is that if it's true that the average of 19 children in Oregon, that's the average over the last 10 years, 4 children will have died of abuse or neglect since this legislature convened in January. This is a very serious public health issue. It's an issue that we need to take very seriously. We need to look at our other areas of the law related to domestic abuse and violence against children in particular. This bill is an important step forward to doing that. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. Any questions?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess actually I want to go back to Section 4. And I just have a couple different questions there, and I might be able to resolve some of them here really quickly. And the question would be addressed to you as well as to Joan. The issue dealing with the critical incident response team, I guess acronym would be CERT, obviously. But for
thank you.
Just
I appreciate
it. You don't see that as being an interference with the investigation from the district attorney's office, since they're totally in charge of what occurs in the county.
The district attorney's office is totally in charge of what happens in the county. The CERT process, which is in place, it is being used for child fatalities. They have a process. There's a 30-day report and a 90-day report. I was reviewing them last night, and one, for instance, indicated that the 30-day report was delayed due to the ongoing criminal investigation so that it did not interfere. And that's one of the important reasons to give some discretion to the department in terms of making its administrative rules for the implementation of the CERT.
Okay, and
follow up.
Do you see the possibility with the members from the Department of Human Services jumping in as maybe a cooperative type investigation with the law enforcement community involved with this situation, or a dual investigation?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Olson, I'm glad that you asked that question. This is an investigation that would be different. The district attorney would be conducting an investigation into the facts of the case in order to prosecute the crime. This investigation, this review, would be to look at the Child Protective Services system. It would be an investigation into the system rather than into the suspect. And I do think that it's cooperative. And one of the things that I think is very important about ensuring that this happens every time, first of all, this is the ultimate failure of the system, and it would make sense that we want to go back and look at it. It's also a very politically, emotionally, and socially charged type of an issue. And rather than picking and choosing which ones we go back and review and creating kind of a witch hunt mentality when each of those things happens, by just knowing this is our practice, this is what we do in this circumstance, we go back to look to see if there's anything that we could have done better to protect that child. So I think it protects the system and some of those workers within the system that we have to remember this is a tremendous trauma for them as well.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Any further questions? Representative Cowan.
I have a couple questions, if I could, Madam Chair. First of all, we have Dash 4 amendments, too, and I'm just wondering if they're significantly different than Dash 3 that you were describing, I believe.
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, the difference between the Dash 3 and the Dash 4 is that in the Dash 3, those injuries are described as suspicious physical injuries, and in the Dash 4s, they're described as apparent abuse. We have a new language that we're thinking of putting in as of Friday night at about 6 o'clock, was if a person conducting an investigation observes a child who has suffered apparent abuse and has reasonable suspicion that abuse has occurred, the person making the observation shall all of the rest. But that's the only difference, is what the word is.
You had mentioned that, and I just didn't put it together with these two. May I have a second question? Thank you. It's a little bit difficult for me to ask this question, but I think it's important that we talk about it. I'm wondering how different the practices that are described in this bill are from the current standard practice. And I think what I'm getting at is there's no question as to what a tragic and difficult case this is to talk about for everyone involved, and I guess I'm trying to ask if this is really a tragic anomaly or whether there are real gaps in the system as opposed to gaps in this case. You said that current law talks about skilled, complete, and therapeutic investigation. So that's what my mind is wrestling with, is whether this case was just tragically flawed or whether it's different than most other cases that are reviewed.
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, I think that that's a very good question. I went back and read through some of the other CERT team responses, mm-hmm. and of the I forget how many are there. It's about a dozen that have been done so far. At least one other had cited as one of the issues was failure to have access to a trained medical professional that understood child abuse injuries. I think one of the difficulties is the Department of Justice was very helpful in providing me with the county protocols from each of the county multidisciplinary teams, and some were very different from others. In this case, the county protocols, including in the December incident where you've seen the photos, the county protocols were followed. So this would be a change in some counties for the way that, these things are investigated and what happens with photos and whether or not a child has access to a physician to do a child abuse medical assessment.
Follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe you could describe one of the folks testifying could describe a little more in detail the role of the, I believe it was ABC House. I'm familiar with Lincoln County. We have a children's advocacy center, and the whole goal of that center is to have a place where children can have all of their investigations done with medically supervised investigations and to eliminate the trauma for the child in the process of necessary investigations. So I guess I'm trying to compare my knowledge base to what perhaps ABC House does in Benton County.
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, Dr. Carol Chervenek from ABC House is here, and she will be testifying.
Okay, maybe
next,
I'm jumping
and she might,
on that.
Unless either of you would like to add to that, she might.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Joan, this is more for you, and this comes Section 5. It deals with the collection of evidence for photography. There, in Subsection 2 talks about should a, you know, photographs be taken within 48 hours, that those photographs will then be provided either to, Subsection B, law enforcement, or Department of Human Services. Did you see an issue for that time expansion for the chain of evidence, and do you think that maybe you can easily articulate and support that process for, you know, assure that there's not going to be an issue for, you know, attacking that?
Attacking the 48
You know, as a, you know, if I was a defense attorney saying, well, how can you really prove that that's the case because you don't have a policy in place or something like that for that example for chain of evidence?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Olson, I don't see that as becoming an issue. Sometimes photographs are attacked because they don't completely show the details that were visible to the human eye at the time they were taken, and also bruises emerge at different rates and they heal at different rates, and injuries emerge and heal at different rates as well. And so there's a plethora of areas that defense attorneys can try to make hay out of, and those are very, I wouldn't say easily, but, you know, competently resolvable with a witness who has some training in the field. And also with the onset of digital photography, there's areas that defense attorneys can also try to, you know, imply that the photographs have been tampered with. That really hasn't become an issue. It all really comes down to, you don't just throw a photograph into evidence and then have the jury make what they will out of it. You always have to have witnesses who say, who compare that to what they actually saw, and who talk about the conditions under which the photograph was taken and whether the photograph has been altered in any way. And so there are rules of evidence and cross-examination and also medical experts who always are helpful to resolve any issues that may be brought up by defense attorneys. To try to impeach the validity of the pictures. In terms of the time frame, you're going to get different pictures depending on the camera, the photographer, and, you know, whether it's 6 hours, 12 hours, 24, 48 hours. So I think that having a broad frame that with built-in flexibility is helpful.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any further questions?
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And just for the record, Kathy Kaufman of Children's First for Oregon was planning to be here today and is home with a sick child. So you have testimony there. Children's First for Oregon is supporting House Bill 3328.
Thank you, Representative.
Madam Chair, if I could be allowed to just briefly respond to Representative Cowan's inquiry. I have utmost respect for all the professionals who are involved in the investigation of Carly's death. They vary in amounts of training, but more often than not, photographs are not taken in cases like these. But a lot of it has to do with equipment availability and that the responding officer or detective or caseworker is thinking and juggling so many different things all at once. As simple as, are there risks in the area and they need to complete their investigation quickly? So I just need to clarify that. I don't think this was an anomaly. I think that, and I would have to say that more often than not, as a prosecutor, I wish that there were photos taken and they weren't taken. It just doesn't happen as much as it should. And so I think that this bill will be helpful to all communities and all agencies. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you again. Carol, I'm not sure how to pronounce this.
Trevenek.
Joanna Engel and Penny York.
I am Dr. Carol Scherbenak. I'm the medical director of ABC House, so hopefully I can answer some of your questions. ABC House is the Linn and Benton County Child Victim Assessment Center. There are 18 or 19 similar centers across the state of Oregon. Oregon is a leader in having this this kind of format where there is a child-friendly environment to do multidisciplinary investigations of child abuse. I do have a few comments I would like to say formally. Several years ago, in a small town in Oregon, a six-month-old male infant was brought to his physician because he had decreased appetite. That infant was noted by the physician to have a swollen upper lip on the left and a small bruise on the right temple. The physician accepted the offered explanation that the infant had slipped in the bathtub the prior evening. 1 week later, that infant was dead from abusive head trauma. The father of that child had shaken the infant, hit him in the face, and hit him in the head until he was dead. Child abuse is a major cause of morbidity and mortality in the United States, and over 1,400 children die every year from inflicted injury. 80% of those deaths are in children that are under 4 years of age. Child abuse is the leading cause of injury deaths among infants and the second leading cause of injury deaths in older children. Studies of child homicide show that many of these children are seen by their physicians and other health care providers in the weeks leading up to their deaths, and often these injuries present with injuries that are diagnosed as accidental. In a study of 173 abused infants, the study showed that nearly one-third of those infants had been with inflicted head injury, which, by the way, is the number one cause of fatal child abuse, were misdiagnosed on their initial presentations for medical care. Dr. Carol Jenny from Brown University has said child maltreatment is a deceptive and easily disguised entity. The diagnosis of child abuse is extremely challenging. The early recognition of child abuse is critical to preventing further injury or death of a child. A child who has been abused has approximately a 50% chance of being abused again. For health care providers, there are two very important scenarios regarding medical diagnosis that are beginning to emerge. Number one, how important it is to be familiar with the rapidly growing body of medical knowledge surrounding child injury. Most physicians who are currently practicing have had either no education regarding child abuse or just a few hours. Less than half of pediatric residencies currently require any child abuse rotations. Early signs of child abuse are often subtle, and the histories offered by offending caregivers are often inaccurate. Healthcare providers with child abuse education have been shown to detect and diagnose child abuse twice as often as inexperienced providers. Second, the accurate and complete documentation of suspicious child injuries is equally important. Child abuse physicians have long recognized the usefulness of documenting child injuries with photographs whenever possible. Because children's injuries heal rapidly and frequently disappear by the time a child can be evaluated by a physician with child abuse experience, documenting those injuries accurately is critically important. Therefore, photographs have become a useful medical tool for consultation with other physicians, and they aid in accurate diagnosis, distinguishing between accidental and inflicted injuries or non-traumatic conditions. Child victims are unable to represent themselves and are often too young to describe what they have experienced. It is up to professionals who care for children, as well as those who set policy, to ensure that we do everything possible to detect and prevent further injury to children. Thank you.
Doctor, I see that you read from some written materials. If you could give them to us, that would be great.
I did. We'll submitted it to her. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Would like to be next.
My name is Joanna Engel. I'm the Executive Director of CASA Voices for Children in Benton County. CASA stands for Court Appointed Special Advocates, and we work with abused and neglected children who are under jurisdiction of the state. Carly did not have a CASA because she was not under the jurisdiction of the state. At the time that Carly was killed, I was not working with CASA. So when I moved to Corvallis and heard about this, I started asking everyone involved, how could this happen in a community like Corvallis? And what I was told is that it had been staffed at CART and that there were not pictures available. And I was told if there had been pictures, this never would have happened. I believe that the descriptions of child abuse are open to interpretation. And so you sit there in the cart with DHS, with the law enforcement, and you hear these cases, and they'll say, there was a bruising on the face, there was a bruising on the arm, but you can't really know until you see an actual picture of the child and what that means. A child is not able to tell their story often. And if they do, as in Carly's case, they were told to tell the wrong story. A picture gives an accurate story. A child suffering from abuse will often exhibit behavior that makes it difficult to pinpoint the cause of that behavior. So having a third party do an assessment as a screening for early intervention services would also be critical in helping keep children safe. I would also like to say that the people who were involved with this case are good, caring, they're qualified people, and they want to do the best for the children in the community. And still, this happened. We need to put a few more layers into place to protect the children of our community, and also to help the caseworkers do their job. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Penny York. I live in Corvallis. I'm the Executive Director of Strengthening Rural Families in Benton County. I've worked as a counselor with infants and teens who are in the care of Los Angeles County Department of Children's Services. But most importantly, I'm the grandmother of a 14-year-old child who came into our family after she was removed from her biological parents' homes because of abuse and neglect. When she was 8, she became foster child to my daughter, and she was adopted at 11. And I'm happy that she's my granddaughter now. So I'm speaking of this personally. I support HB 3328 because it will help keep children safer. Section 3 establishes standards for immediate assessment of a child. Children throughout Oregon need to be safe and need the protections this bill will provide. Right now, there's a lot of variation county to county. That's not really good enough for us. There's a lot of variation in the rural areas where there isn't as great an access to care, and that's not good enough for Oregon. DHS and law enforcement need to act rapidly and decisively in each and every case where the young child has injuries that research has shown can be indicators of abuse. Young children cannot speak for themselves, but their injuries do speak to us. Often it takes a while for professionals to be able to determine the cause of suspicious physical injuries. During that time, they are investigating the causes. The child needs to be safe. Section 4 requires immediate investigations into the death of a child under certain circumstances. We have to do the research. We try and set up really good systems that protect children, and they're flawed. Systems that people create are flawed. We need to look into them when there's a problem, figure out what was wrong, not just fix it in that case. Too late in that case, but fix the system so that it will be better, improve training, do what we need to do to learn by that tragedy. Saturday, I drove to Kinko's to make my requisite 20 copies, and I brought my granddaughter with me, and I let her read my comments. I wanted her to know that I was going to refer to her and make sure that was okay with her. And she had some reactions, and she said I could share with you what she said to me. First of all, I talked a little bit about Carly's case, what I knew. My granddaughter did a little double take when I said that because my granddaughter's name is Carla, and I think that was a little close for her to hear that. As I talked about that case, she just hung her head and shook her head. When I said that it's different county to county in when people can intervene, or when they do intervene, and that in Benton County, apparently they don't have to take that child for assessment unless there's a life-threatening injury. She got angry and said, how many times are they going to go back to that home to make sure that child is okay? She volunteered that you can't trust the kid who says nothing's wrong because they may think it's their fault. As a grandmother, that worries me for this child who grew up in abuse and chaos. And identifying with feeling like that can be her fault, their fault. And then she said, I'm glad you're fighting for this, Grandma. And so I want to thank you for fighting for this. I want to thank the other speakers for fighting for this and helping keep kids safe in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions from anyone on this panel? Representative Gelsick.
I have a quick question for Dr. Chervenek. Thank you, Madam Chair. You heard earlier one of the last pieces that we're working on in that definition is how we describe these injuries. Do you have any thoughts on the use of suspicious physical injury versus apparent abuse?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Gelser. I personally favor the suspicious physical injury. For some reason, it is very difficult for the community physicians to, I guess they see it as a risk, to make the diagnosis of abusive injury. And even though what is written in the current law is that physicians need to report simply if there is a concern of inflicted injury, they still misunderstand that as thinking that they have to make the diagnosis of abusive injury before they report. And this is something, as a child abuse physician, that we struggle with educating general physicians all the time. So I would really support the suspicious physical injury just because I think that it clearly sends the message for physicians anyway, you just have to have this in your one of your top differential diagnoses and be thinking about it and considering it. You don't have to reach that conclusion before you refer and mandate that physician be that patient be seen.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions? Thank you so much for coming to testify. We have Una Swanson and Andy Miller. And is there anyone here? Amy Miller, sorry. Is there anyone here who is here to testify who hasn't signed up? Please come help.
morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Una Swanson, and I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for the Department of Human Services. And first of all, I would like to share my condolences and just acknowledge the courage of the family of Carly that's here today. And just extend to them my probably my personal sadness about the tragedy that they've experienced. We have appreciated working with Representative Gelser on this bill and believe that this is important legislation, and we've appreciated her patience with us as we've offered new language and ideas, and it's been a very good process. I would like to say that the department supports the concepts that Representative Gelser is bringing forward. Of those concepts, I think that the department's access, the caseworker access to trained medical advice in terms of child abuse or neglect is very important. And at this time, it's not always available to us, and we access it when we can. I think the other part of this bill that is important is that our caseworkers are not always certain when it would be okay to ask for a second opinion when a physician has offered an opinion about how the injury occurred. So I think that this has a benefit for our caseworkers and a benefit for children in Oregon. I think clear direction to the Department of Human Services, to law enforcement, to multidisciplinary teams about when and how and in what way to process photographs will be helpful to all of us. And I think that's an area that we would like to reinforce more in working with Representative Gelser. We've also already included some language in our administrative rule that didn't exist previously about timely processing of film, and certainly some of the issues that were raised in this case, we would certainly like to see that they not happen again in terms of what is within our control. I think the identification of children that may benefit from early intervention services is important, and I think that this bill certainly brings that forward. In closing, I'd just like to say that we support the concepts. We were working until sometime on Friday and didn't have an opportunity to see the amendments in the Dash 4, and I know we still have some work to do. And I'm available as a resource to the committee if there are questions.
Thank you, Ms. Swanson. Any questions of Ms. Swanson? Thank you very much, and thanks for all the work that you've done on this. I know you've worked hard with Representative Gelser.
And Chair Tomei, I neglected to say one more thing, if I could. And we also support the part of the bill that identifies more clearly when a critical incident response team response would be convened on at the direction of our director, and the language that we've worked back and forth with Representative Gelser on, I believe, gets us to our place. And I really appreciated what Representative Gelser said. It's not about identifying those cases in which we know something went wrong, but more clearly identifying a group of cases that we could always benefit from reviewing.
Thank you. And I do have a question. It's new cameras are so inexpensive now. I would hope that the department is providing these cameras where they can immediately be downloaded into a computer and put in someone's file rather than waiting for film to come back. Is that a reasonable request of the department?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, that's an area that I would like to look into. I would say at this point, not every office and not every caseworker has a camera. And not in every situation do we have the capacity to do digital photography, if that's what you're talking about. But this is an area that I'd like to look into more, and certainly it's an area I'd like to explore with law enforcement, because I think that and with the DA's office, to assure that when we use photography, we're using what's appropriate in terms of gathering evidence. The Department of Human Services is not a law enforcement agency, but there are certainly times where we are put in a position of of gathering evidence. So it's an area I'd like to explore with them.
We hope you do. Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much, Ms. Swanson.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Amy Miller. I'm a staff attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project, which is a law firm that represents and advocates for children and youth in Multnomah County. We represent several thousand children each year by court appointment in the juvenile dependency and delinquency systems in Multnomah County. We also appreciate the opportunity to work with Representative Gelser on this important piece of legislation. JRP supports the key concepts articulated in HB 3328, including ensuring children who are the subject of abuse reports and demonstrate physical injury receive prompt medical assessments, that pictures are taken of these injuries and are promptly developed, and that the medical professionals who examine injuries have specialized training conducting these types of assessments. I'm here today to talk about one portion of the bill, which is particularly important to JRP, and I'm referring to Section 4 of the Dash 4 amendments, which requires DHS to convene a critical incident response team within 24 hours of the time the department determines that a fatality was likely the result of child abuse or neglect, and the child was either in DHS custody or was assessed for abuse in the prior 12 months. Currently, DHS has a protocol which governs the CERT process. The protocol was developed in 2004 for the following purposes. The purposes are to specify the Department of Human Services child welfare procedures that will be used when a critical incident occurs, to increase the department's accountability to the public, to ensure timely responses by the department, and to increase the department's ability to recommend necessary changes to statutes, rules, policies, procedures, and personnel matters. The purpose of the CERT process is to ensure that a critical incident is thoroughly and externally reviewed and that any system issues related to the incident are examined and improved when possible. Under the protocol, the director of DHS determines which critical incidents require the CERT process, but may convene a CERT for both fatalities and serious injuries. The CERT process is very important because it increases accountability and transparency and at the same time enables system improvement. Even though this formal process exists, a CERT is not convened for every fatality. HB 3328 will require the CERT process for all fatalities where DHS determines the death is possibly due to child abuse or neglect, but it still allows the director to convene a CERT for any other critical injuries. Whenever a death occurs as a result of abuse or neglect, JRP supports focusing agency attention and resources on investigating system issues and developing recommendations for improvement. HB 3328 will ensure that if an abuse or neglect fatality occurs, a review of case-related activities and systems, including policy, practice, and training, and personnel, will also occur. Thank you for considering our comments supporting this bill, and I will be happy to answer any additional questions you have.
Thank you for your testimony and for working on this bill. Any questions? Thank you.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, Political Director for Service Employees Union Local 503. I'm proud to represent the frontline child welfare workers who work with DHS. We support the concepts in this legislation and really applaud the committee for taking on this really serious issue. Our members, you know, strive hard to be part of the team to prevent tragedies from occurring like the one that has occurred, and really to be one of the first lines of defense for abused and neglected kids. There are several sections of the bill that we're supportive of, but we're concerned that in the actual day-to-day implementation won't be able to be executed. Specifically, in the Dash 4 amendments on page 2, lines 14 through 16 and 25 through 29. Chair Tomei, I don't know if it's appropriate. I don't want to kind of get off the topic of the bill, but in other committees, efforts are underway or discussions are underway, I should say, to reduce the number of people who address each individual child welfare case. There are efforts to change the way that the state does business on this front in ways that we feel would be detrimental to children who are at risk. We feel that they'll be difficult to implement some of these important recommendations coming forth in this bill if these changes do take place. And so as you consider moving forward with this legislation, know that budget constrictions and other decisions that are taking place elsewhere in this building will make it more and more difficult to implement these needed changes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Towers. Any questions, Mr. Towers? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? I want to commend Representative Gelser and other people who have worked on this bill. I think you're still feeling like you need some more work on this bill.
Yes, I think we could be ready next Monday.
Yes. So thank you all. I think I can extend the condolences and concerns from the whole committee and probably from the whole legislature for the tragedy that happened in your community. We hope to help so that other tragedies like this will not be happening throughout the state. So thank you for all your work. Thank you for your input. Thank you for your concern and your love for this child who died and other children like her who are losing in our state and throughout our country. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since you are going back to work group, I think Representative Gelser and the work group has done a tremendous job on this bill. I just want to put my two cents in for the support of using the language suspicious physical injury, especially from the comments from Dr. Shervinak. I understand maybe the desire for the what's in the dash fours, but I actually prefer the suspicious physical injury. I think that's going to get at what we're trying to do here. I think that's crystal clear to people, so I just need to make that known right now while you're working on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Madam Chair, could I just quickly say I really wanted to thank again the Department of Justice and the Department of Human Services, Joan Demarest and the Sheehans and the family and all the folks who've come here today. A lot of people have put a lot of time and effort into this bill, especially over the last few weeks, and I've been very grateful for people's willingness to go out on a limb and try to find a way to make things work when there are different interests and needs from different agencies, and it's been a very good experience.
Good. Again, any other comments, questions? Thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3328. We will not be hearing 2994 today. The sponsor of this bill has decided to pull it from committee today, but we are going to have a public hearing, and I will open the public hearing on House Bill 3113. Andy.
Thank you, Chair. Just to briefly introduce the bill, House Measure 3113 is a bill that would amend the duties of the Department of Human Services to include investigations and allegations of child abuse at child care facilities. It would implement this change with one sentence change in an Oregon statute.
Thank you. Representative Maurer. Are you wanting to follow?
Madam Chair, with your permission, I'll open, and Representative Maurer and Don Phillips will also fill in some of the framework here for you. For the record, my name is Linda Flores. I'm State Representative for House District 51. And House Bill 3113 comes as a result of work that was done during the interim, primarily work that Don Phillips had been assisting Representative Gordon Anderson, Representative Maurer's predecessor. The concept here is to catch some of the children who are falling through the gap in child care and child care facilities. There's a gap in the system, and we do have the opportunity to fix it with the concept that we're introducing here today in House Bill 3113. Had conversations last week with representatives from agencies that you'll be hearing from, and there seems to be some concurrence that there is somewhat of a gap, and in fact they have been in discussions over a past number of months about exactly how to go about resolving that. And I think that this is the opportunity to give them the statutory authority to do that. I have been on the Child Care Commission, and hence in that role, and Don Phillips having been kind of the conduit with Representative Anderson and Representative Maurer, decided this would be a good opportunity also to address some of the needs of kids in child care. And I
as a grandmother of five adult children with 10 grandchildren, child care and protecting the innocent has become a very, very huge issue. So I'm hopeful that if you would excuse me, I'm going to leave the rest of this story to Representative Maurer and Don Phillips. I do hope you will understand that this bill does need to have some amendments, primarily because in the drafting process, what we're attempting to do was inserted into the wrong statute and will have to be corrected to amend ORS 419B.005, which is the reporting of child abuse and neglect, rather than under the current statute, which has to do with sanitation issues in child care. That was one of the big oops, I think, in the drafting process this session. So thank you very much, and I'll leave a question and comment to my very, very capable colleagues.
Thank you, Representative Flores.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Representative Ron Maurer, serving House District 3, which is most of Josephine County. And this bill, 3113, is a result of some work that my predecessor did. And there was an issue in my district that resulted in in-home child care and a dispute about who would actually investigate in an allegation of child abuse in that setting. And as a result of that, you had a couple of agencies doing one of these things, which is unacceptable given the testimony from the previous House bill. And so I'm getting to see some issues in the whole issue of child abuse reporting, child abuse in general. And it's clear that we've got a lot of work to do, and this bill touches on one tiny aspect of that. And there are a lot of bills floating around this assembly this time, and we will continue to work on it. But as far as the details, I'm going to let Don Phillips give you the details. But I am supportive of the concept, of course, and it's just the issue of how do we get from point A to point B.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Don Phillips. And at the time this case came to our attention, I was on staff for Representative Gordon Anderson from House District 3 and was also on staff for Representative Flores and continue to work with Representative Flores on her staff on a variety of policy issues. And this case intrigued me because Representative Anderson was so into child welfare issues and Representative Flores was on the Child Care Commission. I thought it was a natural blend to bring both of them together on this and say, there's something wrong here. It needs to be fixed. And I'll just give you the brief lowdown on what happened in this one case. And you have a letter that we've handed out today from the father in this case. He gave this letter to Representative Anderson last year. And I won't get into the agencies' names and staff and that kind of thing because the investigation has already taken place and been closed. And who knows, there may be something that comes of it in the future. But just to recap where the level of frustration came from, you had a father who had a two-year-old son in a child care center, in a daycare. And he had gotten a report from actually a staff member at that daycare that said someone was abusing his child, one of the staff members at the daycare, and in fact had thrown his son up against a wall at one point. And the father got a hold of, called the child care division at the employment department, had called Department of Human Services, had called local police, and each agency was telling him to call someone else. He eventually talked to the governor's office, and they sent him back down the food chain to the child care division. So as you can understand, this is very frustrating from the parents' perspective. They, of course, took their son out of the daycare and then contacted their state representative and said, something's got to give here. Somebody's got to take responsibility, and it's not happening. They also talked to multiple staff members who had left the daycare center, who repeated allegations of physical and verbal abuse going on at the center, and they talked to several parents who had also taken their children out of the center who had similar stories to tell. And so it wasn't just this one isolated case, and we have some old emails and letters from those other staff members and parents, and I didn't want to load you up with a whole bunch of material this morning. So
At one point, there were some indications of sexual abuse. And I don't think any of that was ever substantiated, but I just wanted to throw that in there because some of the children were self-reporting and some of the parents had some suspicions. And so this wasn't just a matter of some physical abuse. There was some sexual indications there as well. The Child Care Division, when we contacted them from Representative Anderson's office, said, we're responsible for health and safety matters, we don't get into child abuse. That's not in our jurisdiction to investigate child abuse. Department of Human Services said, we don't investigate third-party abuse. We'll investigate if it's a familial situation where you have a mother or father, some children in the household, and it's a family situation, but not if it's a daycare. So that's not our jurisdiction. And they both said it really rests with local law enforcement. So Grants Pass Police were the ones that were supposed to be investigating. Apparently Grants Pass Police went out and talked to some of the former staffers, some of the parents, and talked to the people who run the daycare. They asked the district attorney if they wanted to prosecute. The DA said, no, thank you. In fact, we've got copies of the police report, and there's some pretty stern allegations of physical abuse in the police reports. And Representative Anderson at one point did talk to the DA, and the DA said, I don't have enough to prosecute. There's also one line I was reading in the police report that said, we don't have enough to file charges of child abuse, and we're going to be turning our report over to DHS. And, of course, DHS is saying this is not our area. And we also have a letter from the Child Care Division saying this is DHS's area. So as you can see, as Representative Maurer said, you've got a little bit of this going on. And as Representative Olson will probably tell you, local law enforcement has enough on their plate right now. They're not exactly the experts in going out and investigating child abuse. And that's why we rely on DHS to have the experts on their staff to go into any given situation and look for the signs of abuse. What's interesting is when we were kind of talking back and forth with the various agencies and saying, well, why don't you investigate this? Well, what can you investigate? The Child Care Division says, if this child had slipped on a banana peel and hit the wall, they could investigate because that's a health and safety hazard. But if someone on staff had picked the child up and threw him against the wall, that's not our responsibility. And I think it's ironic that if the local police and the DA had indeed opened an investigation into this daycare center, they would have notified the Child Care Division, and the Child Care Division would have shut the Child Care Center down immediately, just based on the allegations that the DA was looking at. So they do apparently have some power under the law, even with an investigation that the police and the DAs use, that they can suspend a license until that investigation is complete. So that I thought that was kind of interesting. At the time, the daycare center had two complaints on their record in the past 2 years. I believe they're licensed once every 2 years. And as we understand now, the Child Care Division did go do a follow-up investigation into inappropriate discipline, is the way they termed it, I believe, and did some follow-up training and some other things with the Child Care Center. But there was never a full-blown investigation into the alleged abuse of this two-year-old boy and the other children and the other parents and their frustration. So that's where that was at, and I just wanted to leave you with an email from the mother in this case to get you to kind of think about where they were coming from. How do we protect our children, and at what point does someone step up and say, and help us get justice? I felt in today's world, you give your child proper health care coverage, good solid housing, and all the other things that children require, and it takes two incomes. So I wake my baby up each morning, get him ready, pack a good lunch, dress him as nice as I can, comb his hair, brush his teeth, put on a funny, silly hat, and a warm coat. Load him in his approved, safe car seat and drive him to a day full of choking, wall slamming, physical restraining, yelling, calling him stupid, making him cry alone on the floor, labeling him slow and autistic, taking away the comforts of home. And all this by the same teacher who smiled at me this morning and took a check out of my hand for $600. As I closed the door to get back in my minivan to start my work day and what I felt was worthwhile work, I was a fool to think that they would make sure the care was, as they advertise, the next best thing to mom. Because I trusted my son suffered, and I'll carry that guilt for the rest of my days. So I'll leave you with that, and if you have any questions, I might be able to fill in the blanks.
Thank you, Ms. Phillips. Any questions?
Madam Chair, this is an issue about a gap in an administrative system, and we need to close the gap. Whether this bill does it exactly, I'm sure that we're going to have a lot of conversations about how to fill that gap, but it's clear that it's going to require a statutory change, and this is the body to do it, and this is the vehicle to do it, and the time to do it.
Thank you, Representative. Okay. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the testimony and for the rundown on the bill. It was very helpful. I'm struck by what you were saying around if the police had acted in a way to notify the child care division with an allegation. So why did that not happen?
I guess because the DA decided not to proceed with the investigation toward some kind of prosecution or some kind of charges. I believe the child care division is here today, and they could probably elaborate on that, but that was my understanding, because the police did an initial investigation, found that the charges or the accusations were unfounded, and decided to drop it.
And the finding of being unfounded was based on...
Madam Chair, I'm Representative Kotek. I guess it was based on after all the conversations they had, after all the interviews that they did, they said it didn't rise to the level of where they could file charges of child abuse. And I might add, we did meet with the agency folks last Friday, and what's great is that they, too, have recognized this gap, and they've been working together to try and figure out a way that they can work together on some of these things. And DHS has experts in the field of child abuse, and if the cops call them and say, would you come in and give us a consultation? Would you kind of help us figure this out? They'd be happy to. But they can't apparently go into these daycares and initiate their own investigation and get the ball rolling and kind of say, yeah, this rises to the level we think charges might be warranted. We'd like to have police come in and do this. So we're gratified that the agencies have been working together and have, you know, recognized that this is a gap. But I think, as Representative Maurer said, we need to give them that statutory authority to get past just a memorandum of understanding.
And we have somebody from DHS here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah.
Ms. Watson, and is there anyone else here who would like to testify on this bill?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Una Swanson, and I'm the Child Protective Services Program Manager for the Department of Human Services. And I'm here today to provide some information from the department's perspective on House Bill 3113. As was stated earlier, the department and the child care division have been discussing the issue of investigations in child care facilities for a period of months. And we support the concept of improving those investigations and identifying any administrative barriers or any statutory barriers in that process. House Bill 3113, as written and referred to in the previous testimony, the way it's written right now is unclear and would certainly have a fiscal impact. We discussed the intent of the bill, and we believe the intent of the bill is to have the Department of Human Services, Child Welfare, Child Protective Services, do investigations of abuse or neglect in certified and, I believe, licensed child care or daycare settings. And that, too, would include a fiscal. What we would like to say is that right now, Child Welfare, Child Protective Services works with law enforcement in child care facility investigations, especially those that have multiple victims to be interviewed. We certainly work together with law enforcement to interview those victims. But when the relationship between the individual who's identified as a perpetrator and the child is non-familial, The person may be an employee or a provider, but they're not in any position to provide ongoing care. That is a different kind of situation. That's more a criminal investigation. And for child welfare, when we do a child abuse assessment, we're looking at the capacity of the parent or the legal guardian. What capacity do they have to parent? We want to know what services we can provide to them, and we want to work with them over time to improve that. So that's certainly different than an individual who may be charged with a crime or may lose their job in a facility. So there's a very significant difference in that process. So, and in closing, I'd like to say if we were to work together, if there were a way in which the department would take a greater role in the investigation of child abuse in child care facilities, we do believe that that would require specialized training that we don't have right now. We do assess with law enforcement, and that would at least, as we're looking at the concept today, may include a fiscal impact.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Kitty Lake, field manager for the Child Care Division, and I wasn't particularly planning to testify, but I thought I'd kind of come up. It's true that our agencies have been working closely together, and in fact, in the particular case that's being discussed, I believe DHS did go out and do an investigation. So sometimes we do get that kind of investigation. I would like to clarify that the Child Care Division is, by statute, a regulatory agency. We regulate the child care, the licenses that the child care facilities have. Our staff don't have particular expertise around child abuse issues, and are not particularly without additional training suited to do child abuse investigations. I'm happy to answer any questions about this.
Sure, there are lots of questions. It would seem to me that if a child abuse report went to a police officer, and it sounds like that's what happened in this situation, and then went to the DA, you'd have to have a lot more evidence, and I should probably ask you about this, than if it went to the Department of Human Services, which is equipped to handle investigations, whether or not it would reach the level that somebody was going to be accused of a criminal act. Is that correct?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, it's true that when the department comes to a founded determination, founded for abuse, it's reasonable cause to believe, which is significantly below what a person would be charged with a crime for.
So it does seem like there's a gap, doesn't there, between what would be followed up on by the district attorney and what the DHS might find, or the child care division.
Madam Chair, yes. I think there's a difference between, for lack of a better term, an administrative investigation versus a criminal investigation. I don't know if the term administrative is appropriate. But when you send a child to a daycare, there's an assumption of locus parentis, or there's a term. When you give your child to someone to care for your child, they take on a new responsibility. And that's why we certify daycare centers. But whether it's a family member or whether it's an uncle or a cousin or a brother or sister to take care of the child, they assume a new role. And so the child care division may not have the appropriate tools to investigate, but it certainly seems like the other side does have the tools to make that investigation, and then they have to parse out where you part ways. But the tools exist. It's just putting it into a different context. At least that's how I see it. And so the issue is, how do we define those contexts? And because I'm not sure that child care division may need those tools all the time, but you because this is, if you don't use these skills every day, you're going to lose these investigative skills. And so that's why you have a complete division assigned to that. So I think we need to figure out conceptually how to get over this hump.
Representative Kotek and then Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think one of the things that I'm trying to wrestle in my head is there's a larger issue of third-party abuse, neglect allegations, and what's going on for the child doesn't change. However, the child's being is potentially a victim of abuse and neglect, regardless of who's perpetrating it. And so it's really challenging because I have to agree with Representative Maurer, you know, you're placing your children in this situation. What do you do in the case of a K-12 situation when there's an allegation of abuse? How is that handled? I'm just curious because if we look at child care arrangements as early childhood settings, how does it work in a K-12 setting if you have a teacher or something, you get a roundabout getting an allegation of abuse?
Okay. Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, in fact, if there's an allegation of abuse by a teacher, is that... Am I understanding it? Mm-hmm. At that point, the Department of Human Services, unless that teacher has children of their own, the department has very little involvement. That's a law enforcement issue. If the teacher is identified as perpetrating abuse on children at school and is also a parent, we may be referred to assess the safety of that teacher's own children. But as far as the teacher in the school, that's a law enforcement investigation.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to understand this better. I can certainly see the points that when things move into a criminal investigation or things move into schools, there are other issues. But I'm trying to get back, and maybe it's because of the testimony from the previous bill, the common denominator is a kid, which from the testimony that I've heard here, your agency particularly has a lot of experience with. So if abuse is abuse, how in the world could we not be involved in child care in this day and age when so many mothers are working and families are working? Wouldn't you have the basic skills to get to the primary source of information, which is the child, regardless of where they were being cared for?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, it's certainly true that the Department Child Protective Service workers have training and skills in the interviewing and in the assessment of child abuse. I think in the term child abuse is child abuse. In the situation where a parent takes their child to school and the teacher abuses the child, are the parents protective of the child? Do the parents need services? Have the parents abused their child? The Department of Human Services and the child welfare system is set up to serve families and to work to keep families together. Do we assist law enforcement with interviews in child care settings? Yes. And there may be some more limited times when we may assist with interviews in the school setting, but it's not routinely the case at all because it is the investigation of a crime that's happening. I would compare it to if an individual assaulted you in the community, someone that you weren't related to, someone you didn't know, that would be a criminal investigation. If an individual assaults a child in the school, that's a criminal investigation. There's not a familial focus to that. We do assist to a limited degree in terms of our expertise in interviewing, but the investigation itself is not the same.
Representative, go ahead.
Well, it's just a thought that's fleeting through my head, and I don't know if anyone else has it fleeting through their heads. But the idea of the child is the child and the type of investigation, I just wonder in light of the previous testimony and my better understanding of how at risk kids are, why we don't sometimes think more of child abuse situations in the home as criminal activities as well, rather than just family events.
But I'll let you answer that. Chair
Tomei and Representative Gelser, we do.
But I would hope before a situation would become that severe that the department would be able to help the family. And I guess there certainly is a gap here, Representative Maurer. And I hope you follow up on this, and I'd be glad to work with you. It seems to me there is a gap here where we need to help these very vulnerable children. Once they're in school, I mean, there's a whole system there to protect those children. But when they're in child care, with this, especially very young children, that they're very vulnerable, and there needs to be more protection set up for those children.
If I may, it seems like the state has already taken a role because we certify these places of business. So the state can't say, you know, it's just a criminal activity. We have to have someone that is trained in saying, yes, this is abuse, whether it's physical abuse or mental abuse. Say, yes, this is abuse because it meets this criteria, and here is our abuse investigation. Now, whether it may rise to a level of crime, that's not really the argument here, but the issue is protecting children beyond just the case we're looking at today. And so, yes, the state has an interest. We already know we have an interest. It's how we get there.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, and, you know, there's another state involvement here, depending on if there are subsidies involved on the type of child care provider. And I guess, at minimum, we have to make sure there's a triggering mechanism so there's the buck isn't passed. And, you know, I'm not wanting to give more work to the child abuse multidisciplinary teams, but it seems like this is the type of situation when there are multiple kids involved, theoretically, that there has to be a triggering of something so everyone's looking at it in a different way versus having a parent have to call around to figure out who's in charge. So I know that's challenging, and I don't think you have these types of cases very often, but there has to be something. So I don't know. I'd be happy to pass some ideas around with Representative Maurer.
Yes, go ahead.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek. I want to be clear that the mandatory reporting of child abuse or neglect in child care settings is exactly the same. The report may come to the department or the report may come to law enforcement. And there are some additional assurances in the statute that we notify the child care division immediately, one or the other of us, or both. And law enforcement takes the lead in those investigations, and it is in the law enforcement piece that they may ask our assistance in doing interviews, but it's in the leadership of the investigation.
So let me follow up on that. So in the case that's been cited, so the case was reported to the police, correct? So, and then I've heard early in testimony that if there was a question about the child care center, then it would be closed down until it had been investigated and found unfounded.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, we by rule close the facility if an investigation is opened, if a formal investigation is opened, either by law enforcement or by DHS, child welfare. We, of course, have other mechanisms for closing a center or a facility. That's not the only time. But if an investigation is opened, we immediately suspend.
But the investigation was not opened because the district attorney said that he or she was not going to.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, it was not opened as a formal investigation either by law enforcement or by DHS. So we didn't have that automatic suspension.
And you could not have, DHS could not have opened it. Why?
Representative or Chair Tomei, I don't want to be in conflict with the other person, but actually there was a law enforcement investigation and there was a Department of Human Services investigation, and it's my understanding both of those came to an unfounded disposition in this case. But it's certainly not our position to say that there aren't issues related to this. In this particular case, actually both of those things happened and they came to an unfounded disposition. But we do recognize that this is an area that we could use some more shoring up to make sure that there's not as much gray areas as exists now.
Great. And I think you can see that from the committee that we're interested in following up on that. So thank you. Thank you both. And thank you, Representative Maurer. And she's gone now, but what's her name?
Don Phillips.
Right. All right. Any last comments? All right. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3113, and I will close the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness.